Xbox.
Morning, it's Tuesday, and that means it's time to get our book picks for the week. It's always a day I look forward to, and we are very happy to have three wonderful booksellers in Studio A to talk to us about great books that they have found that they would like to share with WAMC and Roundtable listeners. Let me introduce them to you, and we will get started. We welcome Connie Brooks and Heather Boyne from Battenkill Books in Cambridge, New York. Hello. How are you both?
Good morning, Joe. You're well.
Really nice to see you, as always. We also welcome Drew Broussard from the Golden Notebook in Woodstock, New York. Hello, Drew.
Hi, Joe. Nice to be here in person.
Good to have you here in person. Thank you very much for being here. Appreciate it. All right. Let us begin with you, Drew, and then we'll make our way through the list.
All right. This first book is maybe my favorite book of the summer. It is called Honey by Isabel Banta. It is a book for everybody who loved or grew up or was just alive during the late 90s, early 2000s pop craze. But it works to sort of rehabilitate some of those stories, which is something that feels like it is very much in the air right now. It follows a young pop sensation named Amber Young, as she goes from being a backup singer in a girl group to suddenly having her own career, but she is slut-shamed. She is dealing with the media narrative of her boyfriend who has suddenly, like, become a Justin Timberlake-style pop star. It's so much fun. It's one of the few times that my wife got to a book before I did, and she was working on finishing a record at the time. We both play music together. She was like, you have to read this. You have to read this. It manages to be like a great summer read while also feeling, I don't know, it just energizes you. It makes you want to go back and re-listen to the old Britney Spears records and be like, oh, this is actually really fun, and maybe we should have been better to her this whole time.
And that is true.
I like that. That's all good. The name of the book is Honey by Isabel Banta. All right, Heather.
All right. So the events of the past 2 weeks have shown us that there's a real possibility that a woman may get elected to the top position in this country. It was not so long ago that even suggesting this would be dismissed as a fantasy. A quote originally attributed to Sir Isaac Newton, but adapted by the women's movement, says, "We stand on the shoulders of the ones who came before us." Some of those broad-shouldered women were from the 18th century, an English salon, and they dared to imagine an active life for themselves. So my first selection is The Blue Stockings, A History of the First Woman's Movement by Susanna Gibson, and it's published by W.W. Norton. In 1700s England, a woman who was an intellectual who spoke out or wrote professionally was considered unnatural. If you search for a timeline of women writers, you'll find that the history has a limited selection prior to the 18th century. And why is that? Because women were not encouraged to aspire to the lofty idea of having anything important to say. I'm not saying that women did not write. They did. But most of these women were not even considered worthy of publishing, let alone including in the canon of great writers. To have thoughts and opinions or to be a leader in a man's world was unattainable. The Blue Stockings did something extraordinary. They came together in salons to discuss and debate as intellectuals equal with men. They fought for women to be educated and to have a public role in society. So these women had all close and complicated relationships. Some rebelled quietly while others defied decent society with adventurous and scandalous lives. Some even had cats. Some did not have children. Be inspired by their courage and raw audacity to break the mold. Now is the time to celebrate them.
Blue Stockings, The Blue Stockings, A History of the First Women's Movement by Susanna Gibson. All right, Connie, you're up.
All right, well, I start with a woman who has things to say.
things to write about. So we just got the list last week of the books that were longlisted for the Booker Prize. And, yeah. and so I have two of them that I've brought with me today. And the first is a novel called Orbital by Samantha Harvey. Harvey's a British writer who has written 5 previous novels and a memoir. Orbital is the story of 6 astronauts circling the Earth in a 24-hour period. Selected for one of the last space station missions of its kind before the program is dismantled, these astronauts and cosmonauts from America, Russia, Italy, Britain, and Japan have left their lives behind to soar through space as the Earth whips past below. The staggering beauty of the planet flashes beneath them, glaciers and deserts, mountain ranges and ocean swells. So too comes word from family members on Earth. In one case, a death, and in another, the threat of a typhoon approaching an island where family members live. This slim novel asks big questions. While the small group of 6 orbits above us, ostensibly to record data and conduct scientific experiments, what emerges are far bigger and broader questions. What are humans without Earth? What is Earth without us? Mm.
It is Orbital by Samantha Harvey, and yes, on the what they call the Booker Dozen, which I think is the 13 books.
The Booker Dozen, I like that.
The Booker Prize, the long list that was announced last week. Do you want to do the other one real quick?
Sure, I can do the other one. So the next one I have, also long listed for the Booker Prize, is Enlightenment by Sarah Perry. Perry is the author of several previous works, including the novels The Essex Serpent and Melmoth. In this story, Thomas Hart and Grace McCauley have lived all their lives in the small Essex town of Adlay. Though separated in age by 3 decades, the pair are kindred spirits, torn between their commitment to religion and their desire to explore the world beyond their small Baptist community. 2 romantic relationships rend their friendship. And in the wake of this rupture, Thomas develops an obsession with a vanished 19th century astronomer said to haunt a nearby manor, and Grace flees Adlay entirely for London. Over the course of 20 years, by coincidence and design, Thomas and Grace will find their lives brought back into orbit as the mystery of the vanished astronomer unfolds into a devastating tale of love and scientific pursuit. And at least one review in the UK, it was in the UK's Telegraph, likened this book to A.S. Byatt's novel Possession, which is probably in my top 10 favorite novels of all time. So whenever I see that comparison, I get really excited.
Good stuff. Sarah Perry and Enlightenment. And again, out and just long listed for the Booker Prize. And if you go to thebookerprizes.com, you can see the whole list there. It's quite impressive. Drew.
The next up is a book called Craft, Stories I Wrote for the Devil by Ananda Lima. It is her fiction debut. She had written some poetry previously. It is a genre-defying collection that I had the pleasure of talking to her about for a podcast I host called Voyage into Genre. It is, the hook of the collection is that a woman meets the devil at a party in Union Square. They have a lovely night of romance together. And she then sets off into her life as a writer, a woman back and forth between the U.S. and Brazil. She keeps encountering the devil, and she keeps writing these stories that maybe are for him. They are maybe about a woman who slept with the devil at a party in Union Square. It's a really wonderfully tricky collection that plays on the title. I keep thinking about the craft that went into this book called Craft. Mm-hmm. There's something for anybody who is a writer or who just enjoys a book that will play with your brain a little bit. The individual stories are great, but she manages to layer secrets into the book. I don't want to say too much, but if you look at the table of contents and start reading the book, almost like a choose your own adventure where you can only find certain pages if you're reading front to back, there are things like that tucked into this book that make you sort of go, I didn't know you could do that with a book.
I love that.
Yep.
Very cool.
Really good.
That is Craft, Stories I Wrote for the Devil by Ananda
mm-hmm.
Lima. is the last name. All right, Heather.
All right. So my next selection is Centered, People and Ideas, Diversifying Design. It's edited by Kalina Sales and published by Princeton University Press. Kalina Sales is an associate professor of graphic design and the chair of the Department of Art and Design at Tennessee State University. This book of essays evolved from her Beyond the Bauhaus writing series, which she advocates for a more inclusive view of design history. This is yet another example of a woman doing the work and putting forth a more equitable narrative. Western design theory has been traditionally at the forefront of formal canon of art history, and it's thought to be more important or more valid or even better than non-Western design. In Centered, Professor Sales says, quote, "My students, all students, regardless of background or identity, deserve to be taught about design from an inclusive, diverse, and global perspective," unquote. After all, inclusion by its very nature is more broadening than exclusion. Creativity thrives on inclusion. Now, some readers may think that this book would be too technical or dry, and I assure you it's not. There's something for everyone. Do you have an interest in cars? Well, there's an essay about truck art in India. Are you interested in world politics? Well, there's Elaine Lopez writes about imagery of the Cuban Revolution. And crafters will find a wealth of knowledge and inspiration in the Guy Bend quilters. Design springs from the very essence of our humanness. Reading broadly about design ideas enables understanding and empathy. Open this book. Try a new path. Broaden your worldview.
Mm. Lovely.
Centered, People and Ideas, Diversifying Design, and it's edited by Kalina Sales. Connie.
All right, I'm going to, the former English major in me is going to nerd out just a tiny bit more on AS Byatt. You knew it was coming. So my recommendation a couple minutes ago was Enlightenment by Sarah Perry, which has been compared to A.S. Byatt's Possession. And I have a connection through Byatt to my next book, which is Blackbird Oracle by Deborah Harkness. There was an interview with Harkness in this past Sunday's New York Times Book Review in which Harkness says that A.S. Byatt's Possession has been the greatest influence on her fiction. And I almost died when I read that. Blackbird Oracle is the fifth novel in the All Souls series, and as with her others, Harkness's new novel is rife with exquisite historical detail, moral quandaries, and not a little dose of magic. Witch Diana Bishop and vampire Matthew de Clermont now have 7-year-old twins. The shadowy organization, known as the Congregation, has demanded that the twins be tested for their magical abilities. In shielding their children from this dangerous prospect, Diana and Matthew will return to Ipswich, Massachusetts, where Diana's family has deep and dark roots. Now, you could read Blackbird Oracle on its own, but you would certainly miss out on the rich backstory that the previous novels provide. And I honestly don't know why you would deny yourself the pleasure of reading the whole series right from book one, which is a discovery of witches.
It is Deborah Harkness is the author. The name of the book is Blackbird Oracle. All right. Drew, go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to do two because they are connected.
Excellent, right. Please.
The first one is coming out in September, so this is a pre-order. It's called Horror for Weenies by a friend of mine named Emily Hughes. It is her first book of nonfiction, but she is, to my mind, the single oracle for horror reading, for horror readers, for horror writers. She is such a good literary citizen. And this book is an attempt to bring people who don't think that they like horror into the horror sphere, because who among us hasn't gone on Wikipedia, let's say, to read the synopsis of a horror movie that you're maybe a little too much of a weenie to go see in the theaters? I have done it.
All the time.
This book is that. It is a bunch of those written with charm, with wit, showing you the connections, showing you why The Exorcist matters and how it can tie back to Alfred Hitchcock, but also forward to Jordan Peele. She does it with such charm and vigor that I want to make it like my big gift book for the holiday season. It's so much fun. And she is also the reason that I know about this next book, A Specter is Haunting Green Tree by Carson Winter, which is out from a very tiny press called Tenebris Press. Emily has led me to so many authors who I love, so many small presses that I love. particularly in the horror and genre spaces, small presses are doing incredible work, and they only survive through word of mouth, really. They don't have big publicity budgets. So this book, I was introduced to Carson Winter through a different book that Emily pushed me towards, and then she was like, oh, you know, he has a new one coming out that is Marxist / Scarecrow horror. And I was like, I honestly don't need to know anything else. I am there to read it. It is a very compelling sort of like woman shows up in a small town. Strange things seem to be happening. Why are the scarecrows all moving around at night? Why are the scarecrows resisting the rich people who own the town? I don't want to say too much else because it's so much fun to experience, but it is a blast. I hope that a dozen people out there go and read it, because that would probably make Tenebris very, very happy.
The name of the two books just mentioned by Drew, A Spectre is Haunting Green Tree by Carson Winter, and before that, Horror for Weenies by Emily Hughes. You were suggesting that as a gift book, which, are you not indicting the person that you're giving that to?
No, you're opening up a world
hey,
to them.
Weenie.
Well, it's like the Four Dummies series, which I cannot in good conscience ever sell to someone, but.
Well, exactly my point. Right. Yes. Indeed. All right. Connie, go ahead.
Okay, well, this is a great segue because I have a horror pick. So this is a book that probably Drew, your friend Emily Hughes, has already read or should read or you want to read. And this is Horror Movie by Paul Tremblay. Tremblay is a master of psychological horror. His novel, Cabin at the End of the World, happens to be a favorite of mine. In his new book, it is June of 1993, and a group of young guerrilla filmmakers have spent 4 weeks making Horror Movie, a notorious, disturbing art house horror flick. However, only three of the film's scenes ever get released to the public. In spite of this, Horror Movie has become a cult classic and has grown a rabid fan base. 3 decades on, and Hollywood is pushing for a big budget reboot. The man who played the role of the thin kid is the only surviving cast member. He remembers all too well the secrets buried within the original screenplay and the bizarre events of the filming and the dangerous cross lines on set that resulted in tragedy. The format of the novel is also unique and one that I have never encountered before, in that Tremblay flows between narrative storytelling and an actual screenplay, which also has the effect of transporting the reader back and forth in time and shatters the presence of the fourth wall, which would traditionally separate the audience members from the cast. The result is a story that is deeply disturbing in the best of all possible ways.
That's so good.
It's so good.
And Emily wrote the New York Times rave.
Oh, that's cool. It's a beautiful circle.
Yeah. It's like we planned all this.
We did not, listeners. We did not.
Horror Movie by Paul Tremblay. All right. Heather.
Wow. Am I going to switch it up?
No horror for you.
All righty. So I'm going to talk about a children's book. The Yellow Bus. Okay. It could not be any more different than these books. The Yellow Bus is written by and illustrated by Lauren Long. It's published by Roaring Brook Press. Lauren Long is a prolific children's author and accomplished illustrator, and some of our readers will know him from his popular series, Otis, the Friendly Tractor. The Yellow Bus was written during COVID. Lauren and his dog, Charlie, would take a daily run, and along their route, the pair passed an abandoned, rusted-out school bus in a field. How is she happy, he thought. Probably like a lot of us during COVID. She's not supposed to be abandoned, sinking into the mud with rust all over her and goats climbing in and out. The bus seemed sad, and as he ran, he began to imagine her life, and her story began to unfold. So Lauren tells the journey of the bus through 5 incarnations. First, it delivers children to school. Then it transports the elderly to the library. And later, parked in a quiet corner of the city, the bus becomes a shelter for people with nowhere else to go. Eventually, the bus gets towed to a field near a river, and goats move in. And the ending is a surprise.
Mm. I like
no
that.
Matter who or what boards this bus. The bus's response is the same, and they filled her with joy. So like the yellow bus, we all have lives filled with change and new purposes and new adventures. Imagine being open and receptive to the optimistic idea that one can be filled with joy, even at moments that seem challenging or unexpected. So Goethe once said, good children's literature appeals not only to the child in the adult, but to the adult in the child. The Yellow Bus is just good literature, a simple story that is uplifting, positive, and soulful. Mm.
Fantastic. The Yellow Bus, written and illustrated by Lauren Wong. Beautifully illustrated.
Yes.
Really gorgeous. Mm-hmm. All right, Drew.
The Bright Sword by Lev Grossman. Talk about joyful books. Lev has apparently been working on this book for over a decade. Wow. It is his attempt to write a modern The Once and Future King. It is Arthuriana, but it does something that I have never really successfully seen before, except maybe Ishiguro's The Buried Giant, which does it very differently. But it starts after the fall of Camelot. A young knight named Colum shows up at the round table, ready to audition. He's like, ha ha, hi! There are like six.
Oh, I got this job.
Yeah. There are six knights left, and they're all like.
Showed up at the round table.
Yeah. Pledged your sword, and now here we are.
Yeah. Yeah.
These few remaining knights are like, boy, did you miss the party? Like, it's over. Arthur's dead. Wow. Guinevere and Lancelot have run off. And he's like, well, shouldn't we still be doing what we're supposed to be doing out there as knights of the round table? Grossman reimagines some of the stories of the round table, some of the characters from the round table, making it more inclusive without ever actually changing the mythology, really. He's just looking at the myth and being like, oh, some of these characters were probably queer. Some of these characters might have been women. It's so much fun. Every character who you can imagine comes in. It's a big, chunky, chunky book. Yeah. But there is such an effervescent joy to it in a way that makes you start to think about, like, why does Arthur still matter to us? Why does Arthur matter to humanity, even not just Western European culture? And I dare say Grossman kind of has an answer in a way that's just magnificent. I will be thinking about this book for the rest of my life.
Wow. I want to read that.
I want to read it.
Yeah. Bright Sword by Lev Grossman. All right, Drew, one more, and then we'll go to Heather's last book, and then we'll be good.
Okay, perfect. Another historical piece of fiction. A debut. It's called Masquerade by a woman named O.O. Shangoyomi. It is set in sub-Saharan Africa, pre-colonial times. A woman who is seen as a witch, she's a blacksmith, she is unmarried, is plucked up and taken to be the wife of a king. Sort of a little bit Persephone Hades vibes. She is thrown into this world that she doesn't understand. She is in love with this guy who seems kind of evil, kind of good. It's an epic, epic story that we sort of know the beats to, but in a place at a time with people who do not get to appear in these stories. I had no expectations picking it up. I happened to pick it up by chance, and I read it in a day and a half. It is one of those just like magical debuts that makes you go, oh, right, this is what fiction can do. It's absolutely spectacular.
Name of the book is Masquerade. All right, Heather.
All right, so to wrap up, my final selection is a book I recently rediscovered. It's the second edition, originally released in 2020 and still available, of The History of the World in 1,000 Objects by D.K. or Dorling Kindersley. It's D.K. is a British publishing company that specializes in illustrated reference books for adults and children. They do them in over 63 languages. I'll always recommend a DK book. It's a fascinating visual exploration of civilization shown through a catalog of objects, a chronology of human creativity around the world. It has very high quality images and descriptions. This one happens to be in conjunction with the Smithsonian. And it enables readers to see visually how people through history have lived and clothed themselves, entertained themselves, cooked, fought, married, died. There's serendipity in stumbling upon a subject that's new and exciting, and I feel that flipping through this book. Adults, children, visual learners, and those who just like to browse will pick this book up again and again. And if you're thinking about a gift, this is a gift.
For more information on all the books we talked about, you can go to Bat and Kill Books in Cambridge, New York. Their website, batandkillbooks.com. The Golden Notebook is in Woodstock, New York. Go to their website, goldennotebook.com, and you can find the complete book list at wamc.org/roundtable. We're out of time, but thank you all very much.
Thanks, great. Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.